All right. Well, some of you were here a few minutes ago. I think all of you were probably here a few minutes ago when I taught in the second service. And we'll be sort of expanding on some of those themes in the direction of mercy ministry right now. Art Pierce, when he asked me to do this, said that I should probably think about 15 minutes on the book, the themes of the book, and then take questions, do Q&A. So be thinking of questions as I talk, but also perhaps questions you have that were based on the sermon a few minutes ago. We can explore some of those themes too because they're intimately linked. I'm going to try to be timely. I know I'm standing between you and lunch, and Art tells me that if I go over time and keep you from lunch, I will be the one needing mercy ministry. So a bit of introduction to the book that's been referred to a couple times. It's really just a little booklet this time. It's not very big at all. 20-some pages, I think. Oh, no, almost 40 pages on what is mercy ministry. It's in a series called Basics of the Faith. The story of this book, just briefly, just so you know how I got involved, was that a couple years ago, as some of you know, at Wheaton College, we ended up with a new president, Phil Ryken, who came to us from 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. And I got a call from Phil soon after I got there saying, Noah, will you come meet with me? I want to pitch an idea to you. So I did. I went to meet with him, and he said that he had been recruited after a talk he gave to write this book, but he told the people who recruited him he didn't have the time to do it alone. And when he left 10th, he also lost the person he was going to do it with. So he wanted to know if I would write it with him. So I just sort of was along for the ride a bit. But we worked very well together and came up with this book that fits well in the series. The book starts by asking the question of sort of what kind of world do we live in such that mercy ministry is necessary? And it talks about, it opens with a section on evil. So there are natural evils and moral evils, right? There's suffering caused by natural things and suffering caused by choices that people make. For a long time, in the Western world, the Lisbon earthquake was the sort of picture of natural evil. People thought about, well, things that went wrong and it wasn't anybody's fault, they thought the Lisbon earthquake. The Lisbon earthquake did massive amounts of damage. Thousands and thousands of people were killed. It's a bit like the tsunami that we witnessed a few years ago. Nobody made the tsunami happen. It wasn't because of anybody's choice that the tsunami flooded out lots of Southeast Asia and killed hundreds of thousands of people. This is a bit like the tower that Jesus talks about, right? Somebody asks about sin, and Jesus says, well, the tower fell on all of them. And was it because of their sin that the tower fell? No. Now, it may be that the world we live in is a world that is marked by these kinds of suffering and these kinds of events because of our sin, and that the new creation God is making and will one day bring to completion does not include these things. But you can't say anybody chose to create the tsunami and all that suffering. Moral evil is different. There's all sorts of moral evil in our world too, and the Holocaust in the 20th century came to replace the Lisbon earthquake as the primary way of talking about evil. In the 20th century, the primary way that scholars and others talked about evil in the second half of the 20th century shifted from the Lisbon earthquake and natural evil to things we chose, moral evils. And moral evils cause suffering to others, but also to ourselves. Some people make bad choices and bring suffering on themselves. Some people suffer because of the moral evils of others. So these are not separated. Natural evil and moral evil don't correlate neatly with, you know, undeserved and deserved, if you get my drift. There are moral evils that cause suffering to others who did nothing to deserve it. And this can be a lifetime of suffering. This can put people in positions where they're vulnerable for a long time through no fault of their own. But those are we live in a world that is marked by both natural evil and moral evil. So we think about how should we act in that world? How should we act in a world where earthquakes, tsunamis, genocides, abuses of, at the individual level, corruption, all of these things cause suffering to oneself or others in the case of moral evil. And we explore different doctrines that have implications for how we act toward others. One of those is, let's say, the doctrine of God. Does anybody know what is the most repeated description of God in the Old Testament? Creator? No, that's a sort of a name for God, but holy? No, that's an adjective we use with God, but what's the most, the one description that's repeated and echoed over and over and over? One true God. No, Exodus 34:6. Is it? Exodus 34:6. Yes, that God is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. This is the most repeated description of God in the Old Testament. So you think about, well, what is God like, and how should we be based on what God's like? We should probably be merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. That doesn't describe me very well, but that is what I should aspire to be merciful and gracious because God is that way. When the Bible says, be holy because God is holy, that's what it means. It means be merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love because God is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. It's not a separate thing. If you were here for the sermon a few minutes ago, you'll recognize that as one of these central points, right? That when James adds on, take care of widows and orphans, don't show favorites, it's not tacking on some new thing. It's part of what it means to be a creature made by God and to image him. And it's part of what it means to be a new creation, which is to be redeemed by God. So it's central to both creation and redemption, to be like God in this way. And if you think about, so that's sort of doctrine of God, you have to link that to who we are through what theologians call theological anthropology, what it means to be a person, a human being. And if that means to image God, if that means to be his likeness in the world, if that means to be his son, like his son was his son, right? His son was the perfect image of God. If we're to be that way too, then we are to be merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. Showing mercy to people who don't even deserve it. Because God showed mercy to us, and we didn't deserve it. And it isn't just a passing on the good stuff, right? We call it pay it forward kind of thing. It's not just that. It's not just out of thanksgiving, oh, God did this, so I guess maybe I'll do nice things too. That's what God made us to do. Ephesians tells us that God planned good works for us to do from before all of creation. This is what God made us to do. Not this is what we also do after we're redeemed. In the book, so we cover some of those themes in the book by exploring different doctrines and their implications for mercy ministry. We also look at the legacy of the church in mercy ministry. We're focused, because the publisher is Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing, they do this series, we're focused on the Reformed legacy, but there are lots of examples. We can look at, I think I want to look at the early church here really quickly. Probably some of you have heard this, but I think it's a terrific story. The early church fulfilled this calling. This is me quoting the book here. The Roman Emperor Julian saw that Christianity was growing due to its ministry of mercy. Christianity, he noted, and this is a quote from Julian, has been specially advanced through the loving service rendered to strangers. The Christians care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. While those who belong to us look in vain for the help that we should render to them. That's what a Roman emperor said about the Christian church. Was, look at them, they're growing because they take care of the poor. And it's not just their own poor. It's not just people in the pews who are needy. It's pagan Romans who are poor, and they're taking care of them. And they're putting us to shame. This is what Julian saw as driving the growth of the church. And then there are a couple other examples. I think you have Basil of Caesarea. He directed the construction of a leprosarium to care for the sick in 366. One of the greatest theologians of the church devoted much of his life to directing the construction of a place to care for lepers. And Gregory of Nazianzus, around the same time, preached his famous sermon on love for the poor. And it was addressed to brothers and fellow paupers, for we are all poor and needy where divine grace is concerned. And he exhorted believers to gain their lives by acts of charity, to appropriate the beatitude that blesses those who are merciful, and to visit, heal, feed, clothe, welcome, and honor Christ by doing the same to the poor and the vulnerable. To talk about some of the specifically reformed examples in the book, the treatment of the poor by the Catholic Church at the time of the Reformation was one of the things that drove the Reformation. If you read Luther's 95 Theses, a lot of the 95 Theses are about the Catholic Church getting wealthier, building buildings on the backs of the poor, and abusing the poor by manipulating them to buy indulgences that were then going to enrich others. Calvin, I'll read you a quote from Calvin here. This is Calvin preaching on Deuteronomy 15, 11 through 15. And he says, "The one who shuts his ears to the cry of the poor shall cry himself, and God will not hear." This is actually very close to one of the verses that we read in Proverbs 22 last hour. "On the contrary, if we are compassionate, moved with pity, and having heard the destitution of the poor, are moved to help them, God will bestow pity and have compassion on us to rescue us in a time of need. God ordained that we should have an open hand to the poor who dwell among us. Since our Lord gives us the means, we must not seek a subterfuge. We must no longer seek excuses, for we shall still remain guilty if we have not used the occasion that was offered to us." And the occasion Calvin is talking about is that Geneva had become a refuge. Refugees from all over Catholic Europe who were Protestant or being persecuted otherwise, they poured into Geneva, and it was full of the poor and the vulnerable. This was the opportunity that Calvin said we must take advantage of. And he emphasized in his organization of the church, the Office of the Deacons, who, according to Calvin, there were two kinds of deacons. One has to receive, distribute, and care for the goods of the poor, daily alms as well as possessions, rents, and pensions. And the other has to tend and look after the sick and administer the allowances to the poor as is customary. The office of the deacon was one of the hardest jobs to do in Geneva. And Calvin made it an emphasis of his organization of the church. Was they were going to do mercy ministry as one of their, not a side thing. We preach, and then we also have mercy ministries. It was one of those things that the gospel drives you to because the gospel transforms you. They're the things that the gospel means, right? The gospel means that we can't earn our right standing before God and Jesus has earned it for us. And then there are the things that the gospel does. The gospel transforms us into the kind of people who don't see it as ancillary to go take care of the poor, like some people do that and some don't, but who see it as central, as part of what it means to be redeemed, to be a new creature. We have a number of other examples in there. The story of Thomas Chalmers in Glasgow, some of you will know that, is really an amazing one, and we have it very briefly here. And then we talk about a number of contemporary ministries. We end with four suggestions for local churches. And I know here I'm preaching to the choir. These things will actually sound, I think, very familiar to you. I know that many of you are involved with Ministries of Mercy, many of you specifically with the rescue mission. And this feels like, you know, something that you could teach me on rather than me teaching you. So I will just go over these briefly, but you'll recognize them immediately as things I think that you do. Well, the first one is don't just give, but become involved using your talents and your time. That's one of our suggestions for churches. Don't just give. Another one is work locally. There are, and these are tied together, right? If you're going to actually give of your talents and your time, and you're not going to be jet-setting all over the world all of the time, then you have to find an opportunity to work locally. There are a lot of churches, a lot of people who sort of have given into exoticism. If it's not Guatemala or Nigeria or something like that, or the Philippines, then it's not, you know, exotic enough for their involvement. I think that's not good. I think that those kinds of ministries are important, that we be involved to ministries to people on the other side of the world. That's great. But it's also important that we get involved locally. Build partnerships. It's not impossible to build partnerships overseas, but when you're working locally, you can actually build partnerships. In Romans 1, Paul says that he's wanted to visit the Romans for a long time. What else does he say? He's wanted to visit them for a long time so that they could build each other up, so they could mutually be strengthened. Paul doesn't say, I've wanted to visit you for a long time because I know how hard it is for you and I've got the goods. I'm hot stuff. He says, no, I've wanted to visit you for a long time because I know that we can be partners in the gospel. And I have something to learn from you. And I will be changed by my ministry in Rome, by my interactions with you. Not just you will be changed. And we need to recognize that we will learn from these things. There's a trip that happens at Wheaton every spring break. It's called Honduras Project. They go to Honduras. They usually do a project bringing fresh water to a certain village. They basically finish what an engineer there starts every year. He goes to a different village, starts the project, identifies the source of water, maybe starts some of the trenches. The students come and bring about 30 people to partner with people in this village and actually lay the pipe in the trenches. And by the time they leave, you can turn on the fresh water. The wrong way to think about that, and this is the way that most students who are new to this project think about it. The wrong way to think about that is, I've got skills of guitar playing, because they do a VBS there too when they go, and I can speak Spanish, and I'm really good with a shovel. And I'm going to go and just be poured out and look at what the Hondurans will get from me. That's a distorted view of what's going on. It's not untrue, but it's the kind of untruth that a distortion is. It's the kind of untruth that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, which is important to making the picture whole, is that those students are going and they're learning something and being transformed too. God is doing a work in their life through the Hondurans that they meet. They're being taught something that they could never learn at home. By that, I mean at home. I don't mean in the U.S. There are places they could learn these things in the U.S. Right? But they're being taught something that they could never learn in a different kind of context. And the final one is to go beyond just acts of charity and to promote justice. There are opportunities that we have that go beyond just these people are poor, we're going to give them things, we're going to help them up, we're going to give them a fishing rod, let's say. You know the old adage about teach a man to fish, he can fish for life. Give a man to fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish, he'll eat for life. There are people who've gone beyond that with that adage. I think that they're right. Sometimes you have to help people get access to the pond. Sometimes you have to help people get access to the pond. Just because they know how doesn't guarantee that they have a place to fish. Sometimes they're excluded, either systematically or just contingently. They're excluded by a certain small group of people or something like that. They're marginalized for one reason or another. They can't fish the pond, whether they know how or not. And there are opportunities that we have to teach them to do more. I mean, this is actually, I'll use the rescue mission as an example, not just because it's a great one, but because you're familiar with it. Rescue mission has a wide range of things that it does. One of those things is its restaurant, where people are actually learning how, they're getting access to the job market they might not have had otherwise, because they're being trained to do something that, and given experience in it. And so that they have a resume when they come out that says, oh, I can do this. Not just I was trained to do it, but I did do it. I did do it, and I can do it at your restaurant too. That's going beyond just, hey, here's a fishing pole, but let me help you access the pond. Walk with me this way. Here it is. Now we can fish. So that's the shape of the book. It starts with the kind of world we live in, the calling we have as Christians and where it originates, in what sort of teachings and doctrines, the legacy of the church in this area, and the ways in which churches might think about their involvement with Mercy Ministry. So we can do Q&A. We got 20 minutes, I think, before lunch is supposed to be served. We don't have to use that whole time, but we can do Q&A about this or about the last hour. Yeah, that's a good question. Did everybody hear that? Okay, it was, so if you've got inside the category of moral evil, you have suffering that happens because, suffering that's brought on someone by their own actions. And if we're not, on the one hand, if we're not supposed to ignore that, on the other hand, if we're not supposed to enable it either, how do you work that out? And how does that relate to what we sometimes call tough love? Well, on the one hand, the first thing I would say is that tough love can be a sort of mercy ministry. So when you are calling someone back to themselves, they're hurting themselves, and you're counseling them to do otherwise, this can be a part of mercy ministry. That's something I think we ought to remember. Another thing to remember, though, is that we're very rarely close enough to a person to really know how that story has played out and how much they brought on themselves and how much was a result of abuses from earlier or things that were conditions they were born into or something like that, and whether or not they really had opportunities to rise above the condition. We shouldn't assume that things were someone's own fault if we can't possibly know that. And we also shouldn't assume that someone, that any individual actually represents the average. This is called the ecological fallacy in logic and philosophy and statistics. Assuming you know something about a population, therefore it applies to all those individuals. That's like if I say, such and such high school, they have a really low average SAT score. Joe Schmo from that high school didn't get into this good college. Must have been because he had a really low average SAT score. Or he had a really low SAT score. That's just fallacious. You can't know that. That's applying what's true of the whole to every individual. He might have had a great SAT score. There's some other reason he didn't get into that college, maybe. That same is true of individuals we see. We can't see someone on the street and take what we think we know about some population we assume they fit into and say, therefore, you know, this person, this real human being standing in front of me, that's their story. So, but on the other hand, we can't enable either. So this comes down, I mean, we've all been in this position where we've been asked for money, I'm sure, by someone we don't know. And this past year, I was in Hyde Park in Chicago a lot. It's a neighborhood on the south side of Chicago where University of Chicago is. I had a senior fellowship there, and there was a coffee shop that I really liked to work in when I wasn't working in my office. And outside that coffee shop, there was someone who asked for money every time I saw him. And sometimes I just didn't see him when I was going into the coffee shop. But sometimes I did. I saw him when I was going in or I was coming out, and I would get him a coffee because it could be he needs that. I wouldn't give him money because it could be that would enable something he's doing that hurts himself. It's a tough place to be. But one thing I'm committed to is I'm not walking away from that situation saying, I know he caused his own problem. I'm not walking away from that situation saying, I'm not giving you money because I know what he would do with it. I don't. He might go in and get coffee. But I'm just trying to responsibly react to what the uncertainty of the situation. Does that help?
Yeah.
Other questions? Questions? Oh, go ahead. Good question. So the question was, in the church that we attend in Chicago, how do we flesh this out? Have we wrestled with the ramifications of this? I'm sure we haven't wrestled with it enough. I do think that we actually had to put a temporary hold on this ministry. Because of someone had to leave, and now we need to find a new leader for it. But one of the ways that we have done this is we've connected with an organization called Mission USA Bridge, and it's an organization that operates out of the west side of Chicago in Lawndale, and they put on a Tuesday night worship service and meal for recently released felons and recovering addicts and gang members. And local churches come and provide the meal and then help with the worship service too. And usually the worship service includes a couple mini sermons throughout rather than throwing somebody into all of a sudden they're hearing a 35-minute sermon. They're about 5, 6, 7-minute sermons. Now, on the surface, this actually works both ways, and it illustrates the partnership idea. We're partnering with the ministry, but the ministry is connecting groups that can learn from each other. Immediately, some people say, well, what are you learning as a church from recently released felons, recovering addicts, and gang members? So on the surface, they're learning everything from us, and we're providing things to them. We're just giving to them, being poured out. But the reason this ministry exists is because when people get out of jail, and when people leave gangs, and when people are recovering addicts, they often will show up in church because of the ministry of someone in jail or in prison, or they'll show up in church because of one of these ministries they visit with afterward, and then we'll make them feel like they don't belong. Because for us, church is people who look and act like us. And they don't look and act like us, so we sort of keep our distance, and then they say, yeah, I know that. This is not lost on them. right? They leave and they don't come back. It's not, well, that was a friendly church, even though everybody was giving them the cold shoulder because they don't know what to do. So what this ministry is about changing churches into places that recognize these people as part of the body of Christ. So that's one of the ways in which we've worked out some of these principles. It's local, it's a partnership. What were the other things I mentioned? Promoting justice, I'm not sure about that. And then the first one, well, the first one was work locally. Oh, at least give, but don't just give. So we take more than just giving money. We actually bring our talents to the worship service and the food and things like that. Any other questions about this talk or the hour before?
So, separate from what we've been talking about, if you were a missions advisor or a recruiter, what would you say to, say, a sophomore in high school that might be considering going to Wheaton or elsewhere?
Good question. Right, right. It's just, yeah, if there were a sophomore in high school. Or something. Right, something like that. So what would I say? Well, I would say that Wheaton is a terrific place that's a great fit for a lot of students who want an academically rigorous education that connects your Christian faith with the things you learn in the classroom where those connections wouldn't be made other places. In biology, in chemistry, where every single professor is thinking about what those connections are and trying to convey them to students in the classroom, but also in their writing and research and publications. Not every one of them, not every publication, but overall in their research agenda. If that's the kind of thing that you want, there aren't many places that will do it better. If you want also to be near a large city where people can easily fly in and out and you can have experts from all over the world there to give talks or access to Chicago, that's also a strength of Wheaton. I would say there are also places that fit students better based on their personalities and that do things very well too, other Christian colleges. In terms of what your focus ought to be at Wheaton, I think four things. I work every year in our Passage program, which is for incoming freshmen and transfer students. It's our first-year transition program. It's optional. No one has to do it, but about half of each incoming class chooses to. And there are four themes: community, service and justice, the life of the mind, and spiritual formation. And I participate in that program as a teacher in it and also organize the urban track of it, because I think those are the right four themes to get started on the right foot at Wheaton College: community, service and justice, the life of the mind, and spiritual formation. So you'd want to come wanting to embrace those things. If that's what you want, is those four things, Wheaton is a place for you. And you'd want to start now thinking about how you would express those values in the next couple years as you build up toward college applications. That's if there were a sophomore somewhere in the room between her parents. All right, well, if there's not another question, I think we're about 6 minutes from lunch, which is the perfect amount of time for a break and to get down there. So thank you all for this opportunity to come chat, and I'm happy to chat more during lunch. So thank you very much.